Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, everyone, welcome back to a very exciting episode of the Storybox podcast. Today, my friends, I'm delighted to welcome Christina Dent to the Storybox. Now, instead of me talking her up and saying exactly what she does and why she does it, I thought it would be best if we heard it from Christina's mouth herself. So, Christina, would you be able to explain who you are, why you do what you do, and exactly what you do?
Yeah. So I'm Christina Dent. I have lived in Mississippi in the U.S. my whole life, born and raised in the capital city of Jackson, and grew up in a wonderful home, grew up in a Christian home and a conservative home and a very happy, cozy childhood. And I was not interested in drugs or addiction. So my introduction to the issue came in my 30s, really, when I met the mother of our foster son, which I'll talk about a little bit more, but that really catalyzed me into this issue of how can we have better solutions related to drugs and addiction. And I ended up learning things that lit such a fire in my heart that I started a nonprofit called End It For Good. And we now operate in Mississippi as well as across the country, inviting people to consider shifting the way we think about drugs and addiction, shifting culturally away from this kind of bad person doing bad things idea and towards an approach that really is backed by the evidence that we know about why people use drugs, what causes addiction, that it really is this complex health crisis, and inviting people to shift away from continuing to approach it through the criminal justice system that we have done for many, many, many years worldwide, especially here in the U.S., and look at the root causes of why we have so much harm, whether it's consumers we're talking about or whether it's the underground drug market that we're talking about, and how can we address those in a way that actually brings solutions, not just more of the same that we've gotten for decades and decades. And so that's what we do. We do a lot of education. We host a lot of events. I do things like this. And I just had a book that came out called Curious, A Foster Mom's Discovery of an Unexpected Solution to Drugs and Addiction. And that's available on Amazon. You can learn more about it on our website at enditforgood.com. But I wrote that book because I wanted to help people see that there are solutions, they're better solutions, and they really can save people's lives. They can change the way our communities and our world operates, because how we approach drugs and addiction impacts every single one of us, whether you're using drugs or not. It's so important that we get this right. And I think there's better solutions out there.
Well, welcome so much to the Storybox podcast. I cannot wait to dive into all the wonderful things that you are doing in the world, especially about your non-for-profit. And this particular topic of drugs and addiction, I mean, I think it is a very prevalent issue in America currently, with the fentanyl crisis just going absolutely crazy at the moment. It's really, really sad to see so many people either homeless, addicted to the stuff, and the criminal justice system, it doesn't really solve the issue. It kind of makes it worse, I've noticed as well. So I guess to start, what got you involved in this whole drugs and addiction saga and starting the non-for-profit? Because you grew up in a conservative Christian home, you didn't really touch drugs or anything like that. So what got you involved?
Yeah, so I was in my early 30s, and my husband and I became foster parents. I did not know anything about addiction at that point. I did know that the majority of children in the U.S. are in foster care because of some sort of drug-related cause with their parents. But I didn't know really anything other than that. And so I brought the way that I kind of grew up thinking about drugs and addiction, which was kind of what is the culture saying? And the culture was saying, these are bad people who are doing bad things. And if they're addicted, they're really bad people. You know, that this is jail is the place for people who are engaged in this activity. So we became foster parents. And through that, I got connected to a woman named Joanne. She was about my same age and had struggled with addiction for almost 2 decades by this point. She started using when she was 13 or 14 and could not beat her addiction during her pregnancy. So when her son was born, he was removed from her custody and put into foster care and brought to our house. And we became his foster parents. So straight from the hospital, this tiny little newborn. And a few days later, I took him to his first visit with her at the local child welfare office. And I popped his car seat out of the car and I turned around in the parking lot. And here's this woman running towards me with tears streaming down her face. And she runs over and just starts covering this little baby with kisses while I'm awkwardly standing there wondering what on earth is going on. This is not what I was expecting. Because in my mind, I'm thinking a mom who's using drugs while she was pregnant is clearly a mom that doesn't love her child. And even though I'm seeing now what looks like deep love, all of that narrative in the back of my mind is playing through and saying, no, this can't be real. This is just a show. It's just to make a good impression. So we go in, she has 1 hour of visitation with him, and then she leaves for inpatient drug treatment, and he comes back, her son comes back to our house. But she would call me from treatment, and she would say, you know, how is he doing? What's he doing today? You know, he's doing nothing because he's 5 pounds, and all he does is eat and sleep, and that's about it. But she wanted to know all the details she could about him. And then she would say, can you put me on speakerphone? And I would do it. And then she would sing to him over the phone, just taking this one opportunity to connect at a time where that was the only opportunity that she had. She couldn't be there with him in person. And even though he's just this tiny baby and we think he doesn't know what's going on, he does. He recognizes his mom's voice and she knows that. And she uses this one opportunity to connect with him. And to be at the, like in a front row seat to that kind of, I just felt like sacred ground. Like I'm witnessing something that is generally kind of kept behind a closed door, you know, to express that kind of vulnerability in showing love. We don't usually do that in public. And yet I could see that because of the situation with being his foster mom. And she let me see that. She didn't hold me at arm's length. She let me see who she really is. And the more I got to know her after that, the more I realized this is all real. This is all true. She really does love her son just as much as I love my sons. And while that sounds like, oh, that's a wonderful thing, it is a wonderful thing, but it challenged everything I thought about people who were struggling with addiction, about moms who were using drugs while they were pregnant, because I could see now that she both loved her son deeply and was a mom like me, and she was struggling with this really complex health crisis and needed help for that. And seeing that just got me curious. It's the name of the book, because it is really like, if I had to pick one word for my journey, it is this spark of curiosity. Wait a second. We're putting people just like her in prison for exactly the same thing that she was doing. I mean, she was using drugs she was buying on the street that were not legal. So what are we doing? Because if we're putting people like her in prison, and I can clearly see that that's not going to help her It's going to leave this baby without his mom. It's going to put her in an environment that she can still get drugs. I mean, you can get drugs anywhere, in jails and prisons included. It's not going to help her with the addiction, and it's going to kind of tear apart this already vulnerable family unit. And so for me, I could go back to some of those values that I grew up with and say, wait a second, this doesn't feel pro-family to me. This actually feels like we're tearing families apart, not supporting them to remain intact. And I'm really not sure that jail is going to actually help her overcome this addiction, because she really needs help. And that just catalyzed this learning journey for me, starting with, what have I misunderstood about people who are using drugs? And that cascaded into, oh, wait a second, there's this, all these other pieces. Why are so many people dying from overdose? Why is there so much crime related to the underground drug market? And that just opened this whole new world to me and gave me a very different set of solutions than the one that I had grown up with. And I just became convinced that those solutions are the path forward, and the fire is still going in me. Several years later, Beckham, her son, just celebrated his 8th birthday. And so it's 8 years ago, this spark just started. And I continue to think this is one of the most significant ways that we could decrease the level of harm that's happening to already vulnerable people and increase the opportunity for a lot more people to be able to build a thriving life and a life that they want to be fully present for, which is the key if we're going to address the addiction crisis. How can we help people build lives they want to be present for instead of numbing?
I think very much like you, I grew up in a conservative Christian household, and obviously stay away from drugs, alcohol, sex, pornography, all these elements which can lead into addiction. But funny enough, even though I was told don't do it, and to see the ones that did struggle with it as evil and there's something seriously wrong with them, I ended up with an addiction to pornography and then other addictions later on in life. And then I was like, I feel miserable. I feel terrible. I feel like a broken human being. And wanting to reach out for help was hard, because I didn't feel like, at one stage, I didn't feel like I needed help. And the second stage is, what if people judge me? Because that came from the conservative upbringing of, you're a sinner and you're terrible. But then again, Christ came to save those who are lost, and he knows that we're going to stuff up. So looking at the older I get now and seeing people that have addiction, I have a lot more empathy, not just with my own journey, but those people that deal with drug addiction or any kind of addiction of that matter, it doesn't mean that they're broken human beings. It means that they have a susceptibility to that form of addictive substance or behavior, and it's hard for them to get help. So I think we need to reshift the narrative. But nowadays it's like, let's get them off the street by putting them in prison so that they can continue their addiction. Like, that's not helpful to anyone. So how do we, all that to be said, how do we start restructuring this narrative that these people are not evil? How do we help them?
So I think one of the stories that I tell in Curious is about Rat Park. And it's helpful to me because, for one, it's a memorable story. People will remember. If you don't remember anything else from this, you're going to remember about Rat Park when I tell it to you. But also, I think it helps us see that roadmap for what is actually going to help. So Rat Park started, 50 years ago. There was a professor who was studying addiction, and he was in a clinic helping people who were struggling, and he was also a professor. And his students, he was coming to the clinic and saying, wow, people are actually telling me what's going on in their life. And here I thought these were bad people. And actually, if I listen to their stories, their drug use makes perfect sense. If I lived their life, I would want to use drugs and not have to really face all the feelings that come with what they've been through. But then when he went to his students, they said, no, that's not true. No, that's not true. You know, there are already these experiments that have been run with rats where you put them in a box, you give them access to this, you know, pure water or heroin or cocaine-laced water, and they choose the drug-laced water. And it's because these drugs have almost this life of their own. They take you over when you have access to them. And so Dr. Alexander said, well, that doesn't make sense because we know that rats are social creatures. So if you take them away from their friends and you put them in a place with nothing to do, that would kind of make sense that they would not want to be present in that place. So he and his colleagues built Rat Park on the floor of their lab, and they had toys for the rats to play with, lots of rats to be in there that they could hang out with. They everything that can make for a happy rat life, they put into Rat Park along with the regular water and the drug-laced water. And what they found is the rats almost never chose the drug-laced water. And even if they did, they did not use it in excess. They didn't use it in order, you know, to get to a point where they would actually overdose on it, which they had in the previous experiments. And that became this 50-year journey for him over his whole career. He's retired now, but over his whole career, over shifting the focus away from what the thing is we're addicted to and towards what is it doing for us? What is it about our life that makes us not want to be present, that makes us go back to these addiction processes? And I asked him, you know, talking about just different kinds of addictions, I asked him when I was interviewing him for the book, in his 50 years, has he seen sort of different causes for different types of addiction? And he says, show me the research. If it's out there, I haven't seen it. And I have nothing in my experience has shown me that. It's they're the same things that draw us. People latch on to different substances or processes, but the root cause of all of those is very much similar things, certainly specific to the person, but it isn't that, you know, a certain kind of you know, person is going to become addicted to X and Y. It really is those core problems. And each of us reach for different things that fill that void for us. And, you know, I even think, so I think of myself not as a person who's ever experienced addiction or is in recovery. And yet the more I learned about this, the more I thought, this actually explains a lot of my relationship with food. Like this is how I use food. It's, you know, when I'm really stressed out or when I am feeling stuck or when I, you know, whatever the negative feeling is that I don't really want to have to face, I go open the fridge and see what's in there. And, you know, so now that's a very socially acceptable thing. So no one's going to look at me and say, oh my goodness, you're a terrible person. But it really is coming from the same place of all of us having experiences that are difficult to be in the moment with and wanting to find some other way to make it through those feelings other than actually kind of being present with those. So I think that helps us to think about how do we approach addiction? It is, we need to stop focusing on what the person is doing and go to the core of why is it what is that doing for them? What void is that filling? What experience is it pushing away that is difficult to be with? And that learning that part of it for me was really heartbreaking because the way we've approached addiction, whether that's through the criminal justice system or like you were talking about, just through shame, we have said what you need is punishment to stop doing this destructive behavior. And the more I learned about addiction, the more I realized that really is the opposite of what people need to be able to overcome this. They don't need to be pushed away and separated from society, separated from their job, separated from their family, separated from all of the meaningful things in their life. no, they actually need the opposite. They need to be drawn into those to help them be able to overcome this part of their life that is not serving them well and that might be incredibly destructive. And I think that's where we're going to start to see better outcomes. So I see it as two things. One is stop doing the wrong thing. We want to stop using the criminal justice system for drug addiction. We would think it was crazy to use it for lots of other kinds of addictions, for people who are addicted to video games. I mean, the thought of arresting people for that, we think that's ludicrous, but it's still stemming from similar things. We don't do that. I would say we should not be using that for things like drug possession that you might catch someone in because they're addicted to a substance. So we want to stop doing the wrong thing and also do more of the right thing, which is really think through how as a society, how as a faith community, how as a family, can we gain the tools to come alongside people who are struggling and to build the kinds of communities that help prevent addiction from growing in the first place. I mean, one of the things that people will read in Curious is I have difficult things that happened in my childhood, things that I went through. Now, when I look at that and say, why wasn't I using heroin by the time I was 24? I look and say, well, I had all of this support around me as I went through those things. I had family, I had our church, I had a solid group of friends, I had all of their parents, I had all of this network of support and love that surrounded me through those experiences. That's what we need to be working to build so that everyone has these kinds of support systems around them that can help prevent it from ever happening in the first place and can also help people, you know, catch it early on, come out of it before it gets very deep. And if it does get very deep, how can we walk along with people so that they can find a pathway out?
I remember Johan Hari telling me the Rat Park story. And for those of you that don't know who Johan Hari is, he's brilliant in this area as well, as you are too, Christina. And it's so amazing to me how we know all this stuff, especially people in positions of power that can make a huge difference in this particular space, but they choose the opposite. They choose to lock them up, which costs more money. They choose to stigmatize, and then they choose also to break up the family unit. They also choose to put them in a place where the addiction is going to continue, not really get help. And it costs them 10 times more money for that to continue going on rather than actually saying, all right, let's clean up the streets. Let's put these people in positions where they can find meaning, connection, and healing, because that is definitely possible, because that's what they're lacking. So then they know all this stuff, but yet they continue to allow it to just basically unfold and it gets worse and worse and worse. So, I mean, I know in America, it's kind of crazy in certain states like San Francisco. I've seen videos in Philadelphia, for example. The fentanyl crisis is unreal. Like, it is crossing the border at a very alarming rate, and you have more and more users every single day. And like, from your perspective, how can we end that? Because that seems like a very, very big problem.
Yeah, it is. And I think, so the first part of what we talked about on the consumer side is a little more easy for people to kind of begin to rethink, okay, I can maybe think about that. But when we get over to how do you solve the fentanyl crisis, we get a lot more challenging solutions, even solutions that for me still feel uncomfortable. But I look at the root cause of why do we have a fentanyl crisis? Why are so many people dying? It's not because of fentanyl per se. It is because people are using unregulated fentanyl that they're getting off the street, which is, there's no quality controls. There's nobody making sure your packaging is correct, that you know what's actually in it. And one of the examples that I give in Curious for that is when my youngest son was four, He cut his finger very badly and had to go to the emergency room. And we go in and they're, you know, trying to get him calm. And the nurse comes in and she says, "Hey, I'm just going to give him some fentanyl and we'll get ready to, you know, put the stitches in his finger."
Mm.
So you've got a four-year-old who's going to be given fentanyl, and you have newspaper headlines talking about grown men and women who are dying from fentanyl overdose. What's the difference? Why is that? It's not fentanyl. It's that in a medical environment, you can give the exact appropriate dose because you know how much you're giving. You know the weight of the person who's taking it. You can dose that fentanyl appropriately. That's not what's happening out on the street. And so, unfortunately, in the U.S., we've had this convergence of harm that has created what we have today. So we have drug prohibition. So the prohibition of the drugs people want to use, let's say heroin, for example, they can't buy that legally. They have to buy it illegally on the street. Now, it's not hard to get. It's everywhere, but you still at least can't buy it in a store. It's not regulated. You are taking lots of risks because you're buying a little bag of who knows what when you get it. So you have a lot of people using drugs they bought on the street. Here in the U.S., illegal drug use has doubled in the last 20 years. So that's a whole lot more people who are using this contaminated supply. That averages out to 1 in 10 Americans use drugs recently. You know, they're using them. It's not like they did it 20 years ago. So 1 in 10 adults is accessing this underground, unregulated drug supply. Then you have the emergence of fentanyl. Now you have a very high potency opioid that is part of that unregulated supply. So we had overdoses. There's always been overdoses. They are primarily a feature of the underground market. They pretty rarely happen in a situation where you're getting a drug that you got from, you know, a pharmacy or something like that that's actually regulated and you know what you're taking. But we don't have that anymore. With fentanyl, we have a harder time for people to access regulated drugs and this explosion of this underground market that is now fentanyl's everywhere. So now in the U.S., we have 100,000 people a year that are dying from largely the contaminated drug supply. And when you look at opioid overdoses, 90% of people have fentanyl in their bodies when they die. So what we have is a crisis of the underground market. It's not an opioid crisis. When we hear opioid crisis, we think prescriptions. That's mm-hmm. not what's happening. What's happening is this unregulated supply. And as we continue to crack down on prescriptions and on the ability for people to access drugs legally, more and more people are moving to this underground market where they're getting drugs contaminated with fentanyl. And many of them are passing away as a result. So when we think about solutions for that, not arresting consumers isn't going to fix the fentanyl crisis because it is a feature of drug prohibition.
Mm.
And that for me was a really hard, it's still hard for me to think about the way to solve this is to allow adults to make a broader range of choices about their drug use legally. We already allow them to make a lot of different choices. You can buy alcohol, you can buy cigarettes, you can buy a lot of things, but can we expand that so that people aren't accessing these unregulated underground, you know, markets that are also causing vast amounts of crime and violence because all of the money that's being generated in that underground market is only made by people who are willing to break the law. So you've got, you know, globally this $500 billion a year industry, which is the underground drug market. And the only people that are getting to spend that $500 billion a year are people breaking the law. So you've got gangs, cartels, terrorist organizations receiving vast amounts of funding from this underground market. So for me, it was kind of like zooming way out and trying to see the whole picture, not just Joanne, not just what's happening to her in Beckham, not just the overdose crisis and how we could handle that, but really saying big picture globally on this issue of drugs and addiction, what are the big levers that could solve lots of different problems that we face related to that? And that's what led me to the conclusion that treating consumers as though their substance use is the health issue I believe it is, not through the criminal justice system, and handling drug markets in a legal, regulated way is the best solution, whether that's, you know, through prescriptions or through dispensary models or through pharmacy models. There's lots of different ways that we could explore that. And there's going to be some pain in shifting back to that. You can't reverse decades of failed policy without some significant pain. But the key is acknowledging what the cost is to keep going in the direction we're going. Right now, we've got the cost of 100,000 people a year to overdose, vast amounts of crime and violence that are destabilizing whole countries in different parts of the world because cartels have basically, you know, bought the government, and all of these consumers that are cycling in and out of jails and prisons, and it's not helping them get better. It's making life much harder. And we keep wondering, you know, why doesn't it work? Well, it doesn't work because we've been using the wrong tools. And I think if we can commit to making the shift, figuring out how to use the right tools and understanding that there's going to be some pain involved in that, there are no perfect solutions where this issue is concerned, but we could get much better outcomes on a host of fronts. And I think that's the work before us. If we want to really find solutions and move away from reactions, most of what we have today is reactions, not real solutions. And I want us to move towards solutions, towards really trying to solve the root cause of the problem.
There's an old saying that kind of speaks to this major problem: follow the money and you usually find the corrupt officials, the corrupt people that are causing the problem to begin with. And have you heard of Dope Sick?
Mm-hmm.
I love that book and show. The OxyContin crisis currently in America. So Purdue Pharma, for those that don't know what ended up going on, the OxyContin crisis killed millions of Americans. I believe it's still somewhat on the street, still affecting quite a lot of Americans as well. One of the biggest court cases, I believe, in America. And it doesn't look like Purdue Pharma is actually ever going to have to pay the problem or really give back the people that they caused so much harm to, or because of money. And I guess where I'm leading to this is, so we're talking about government cartels, and it's kind of scary to think how cartels basically own and run the government. Like, that, to me, that's scary anyway.
But hopefully that's not true everywhere, but I think it's I think we can evidentially say that's true in some countries for sure.
For sure. Like, I can see it happening, no doubt. But Big Pharma, how much is Big Pharma a problem in this instance?
Yeah, so I think, Jay, this is the hardest nut to crack, as we would say here, of this, because so you have two things happening at the same time. One is the whole Purdue Pharma and OxyContin, that whole thing that's happening. And we can look at that and say, where there's criminal behavior, absolutely that should be prosecuted. And that should be, you know, taken to the fullest extent of what the law allows for there to be appropriate justice in that situation. And also, the response to that has been to just sort of crack down across the board on access to legal opioids, which has had a twofold negative impact. So it's not to say there hasn't been some positives, but on the one hand, you have pain patients who are now unable to get opioids that were improving their life. And now, just because of kind of the sweeping move away from access to opioids legally, they're finding it hard to find that treatment. And also you have people who maybe they get cut off and now they're shifting to that underground market. And so what we would want to do is to try to find that middle ground. We're not going to find a perfect middle ground, but where is the middle ground where we can not just open the floodgates and give everyone drugs, but encourage and incentivize people who are currently using illegal drugs to come back into some sort of legal market where they're at least not going to get something contaminated, and bolster our approach to substance use, including social norms around how do we create the kind of social norms that we have around, you know, let's say alcohol and tobacco. So, you know, here in the US, loads of people smoked. And when we realized that that's terrible for your health, we didn't say, okay, we're just going to ban it. We're going to arrest people who use it. We're going to push it into the underground. You know, nobody gets to smoke anymore. We said, no, we're going to, you know, we're going to have some good age restrictions on it. We're going to have certainly, you know, when I was growing up, we had cigarette advertisements on billboards. We don't have that anymore. So there's other ways to do that, including incentivizing. So you get better insurance rates if you don't smoke. You're allowed to smoke. That is your prerogative. You can smoke as much as you want to, but it is going to have some pain points in your life, not just with your health, but with other parts of your life. It's going to be hard to find places where you can smoke. That's going to be annoying. So there's ways to build in good social norms and good incentives for people to make healthier choices without just criminalizing and saying, well, we're just going to kind of cut the whole thing off. And that's really what we want to find, is to say, we don't want to just open the floodgates, but we also don't want to keep pushing people to this contaminated underground market. And how can we have a middle path there where we can recognize that there can be harm on both sides, and we want to try to minimize it both ways. The pendulum swing on either end is not good. We want to find that middle path, which seems to be true in most things in life. The pendulum swing on either side is not good. The middle path is often the healthier one.
I want to play the devil's advocate for a moment, because speaking about what you were just referring to, I saw a video, Tyler Oliveira, he goes to all these different places and he investigates, like, he, especially like in places like San Francisco, he went to Canada, and Canada has legalized drugs over there. So anyone's allowed to use over there. And I think it's in Canada where they've got these centers that have been set up to basically stop the flow of the terrible drug and give them the better version of the drug. But now those centers have been overrun and they're crazy. Like, they can't really meet the demand that is coming in. And Tyler went over and he was asking questions, and granted, they're very hesitant to actually answer the questions because then they'll be caught out. Like, the government has given this incentive program for these centers to be set up to stop the bad drugs from flowing in to cause a great deal of overdoses, but they can't keep up with the demand. So someone was saying that they're actually using the terrible drugs as a way to help the person, let's say, meet their fix. Mm-hmm. And so I guess my question is, as the devil's advocate, like, how do we stop that from ever happening? How do we keep up with the demand if the demand is actually incredibly high? Like, should we legalize drug use and say, you're totally fine to use as much as you want if it's in a particular center, and we're going to monitor you while you're using the drugs? But I guess we've seen on the outset that hasn't really worked. I mean, it's a great thought in theory, but it hasn't really worked too well in practice.
So I think I would, so I interviewed one of the doctors for our podcast who works at one of those clinics in Canada. And his take on sort of the effectiveness of it is that when they bring people in and are able to treat them in the appropriate way, that it's the most effective form of treatment for heroin addiction in the world. But it is very difficult to provide that level of care for as many people as are struggling. I mean, the way that their clinic runs, you can come. So cannabis is legal countrywide, but you can only get something like heroin at one of these clinics if you're in part of their program, legally anyway. So you have to come to the clinic to use. So people have to come there. If they want to use three times a day, they have to be physically present at the clinic three times a day. During COVID, they were able to kind of do a little bit of take home things like that. So it makes it really high touch, very high investment for the person as well as for the clinic to be able to provide that level of care. So it's a significant drawback because they can only treat a couple hundred people at a time. You just can't cycle that many people through a clinic who have to come, you know, two, three times a day. And so I think it's a good solution for the people for whom they can get into that program. But like you said, there's far too many people for that to work. And that to me is where the rub of either we continue to, I was talking actually to a police officer in Vancouver where these clinics were first set up. And he said the thing that changed his mind in favor of it was just how many dead bodies he was coming across all the time. And so for him, it was like, I don't really like the other option of allowing people to have more access, but the alternative is so devastating and just horrendous to these communities and to the families and all of the people who are being lost, that it's the least bad option. And I think we do have to think about that in some way of, we want a solution where no one is harmed, where nobody dies, where nobody becomes addicted. But that's not possible. So what can we do? And I think of it really as you know, the ultimate bad outcome is death. I mean, once somebody has passed away, there's no more hope that they can't overcome the addiction. And certainly people are dying who are not addicted. They're just getting something that's super potent, you know, at a party and dying. That's certainly happening. But when we look at what is the ultimate bad outcome, I think sometimes we don't think about the fact that death is a very real potential outcome for people who are using unregulated substances. There's one of the stories I tell in the book is James Moore. And he lost his son to a heroin and fentanyl overdose a couple of years ago. And for him, that was the beginning of this learning journey. And he says, you know, if people had to realize the real, true reality that their loved one could die, a solution like broader legal access to allow people not to use contaminated drugs, that begins to look actually possible and like it could be really helpful. It's hard to get there until we've paid the ultimate price. Then we look and say, what could have prevented that? I mean, now there's no hope. It's over. I've lost my son. So I think we're caught a little bit in that middle ground of, we don't want to have to consider broader legal access, but the alternative has become so deadly that I think we're going to have to consider that unless we're willing to continue to lose 100,000 people a year. And I think that's not a solution that is a good solution, because it is so driven by the contamination. There's lots of people who die from alcohol every year, but it's not from contamination. It's because if you use enough alcohol, it kills you. That's not true of opioids. You can use them for decades and they don't kill you, unless you use too much of them at one time and then you overdose and die. So I think those things are what has me convinced that not just on the overdose front, but on this big picture of crime reduction and all of these other things, that the benefits far outweigh the negatives, and I'm very willing to admit that there are there are negatives, but I think the benefits far outweigh them. And if we can continue to pursue what that could look like, I think we can get to the place where we find the best middle ground of those outcomes, kind of like cannabis. I mean, cannabis in the U.S., so it's kind of been legalized state by state. So we've got, you know, all of these different states that are doing it different ways. And you see different outcomes, and states learn from each other. They say, okay, this state, they had really high regulations and really high taxes, which sounded like a good idea, except no customer wants to buy cannabis at twice the price than they can buy it from the guy down the street.
Yeah.
So then the next state says, okay, that's not going to work. We have to keep the regulations and the taxes in check if we actually want consumers to switch to this legal market. And that very much is how we would think the switch away from criminalization should happen, is very incrementally being able to try different models to see what works, because there is this stabilizing process that has to happen where you're able to develop these social norms alongside new regulations, so that you don't just have this, you know, the door is open and everybody's, you know, starts using. Although for most people, if you legalized heroin today, I mean, you and I aren't going to the store to get it. Most people who want to use it are using it. Most people don't want to use it at all. Doesn't matter if you made it very easy for them to use. I don't have any interest in that. I've never used cannabis. I've been lots of places where it's legal. I don't have any interest in that. Its legal status does not impact my desire to use it. That's not true for everyone, certainly, but there are a lot of people for whom it is true for.
We have an issue here in Australia now with young people and vaping, and we have now made it illegal for young people to vape or to have access to vape, and for shop owners to actually sell it. Now that opens up another market of people finding a way to, it's like human nature. They always do it. If they want something, they will do whatever they possibly can to actually get it. Doesn't matter if it's illegal or not. That just opens up another can of worms that the government hasn't really thought of too well. More and more issues. But yeah, you've got all these young people, which I feel for them, because they'll do it in a group. They'll do it to feel socially bonded, connected. And I mean, peer pressure, another big one. It comes down to it. I mean, I've never smoked, never drunk anything at all in my life, and that was my personal choice. And doesn't mean that I didn't have peer pressure. My goodness, did I have a lot of peer pressure. I was just vehemently against doing anything like that at all. But it's not to say like other people, it's not to say that they're wrong or they're bad for doing it or anything like that. All my friends that I grew up with, they've done something of some sort. Doesn't make me a better person for not trying it than them, because I've got my own vices. They've got theirs. Makes us human. But yeah, this drug issue is massive. It's not going to end tomorrow. There's definitely conversations that do need to be had more of, like what we're having today. I guess to sort of finish up this conversation, Christina, where can people learn more about your work and hear more about what you have to say in regards to this massive issue?
Yeah, you can go to enditforgood.com, and lots of information there. The TEDx talk that I gave is on there. You can get a copy of Curious, my new book. And if you just want to support the cause, you can buy a copy of Curious. 75% of the proceeds of that go right back to End It for Good, for us to continue to do things like this, invite people into a conversation. There's also freebies on the website. So there's 3 ways you can help someone who's struggling with an addiction. There's 5 keys to having productive conversations on really tough topics. So maybe drugs and addiction isn't the issue you're passionate about at all, but you want to know, how can I share my passion on my issue in a way that people will listen to? That's a huge problem right now. People are just yelling at each other and not listening. And if you want more people to engage with the ideas that you have, whoever you are, learning how to communicate those in a way that people can hear and that you can actually have dialogue and someone be willing to learn. We've learned a lot about that, talking on this issue that's very polarizing. So for people that don't know, Mississippi is one of the most conservative religious states in the U.S., already a pretty religious country in terms of how many people would say, you know, they are religious and led by those values. And so part of what we want to do is be able to show how you can have good conversations on tough topics. And Curious is written in that way. I wrote it for people who are not interested in this issue, who are interested in, hey, how could the world be a better place, and are interested in a good story. It's a very narrative driven book. It's really a memoir. It's just a memoir on this particular issue and what I learned. So encourage people to go to enditforgood.com. Would love to have you share with me what you think about it. You can email me, Christina@enditforgood.com. Would love to hear from you. You can give me all your devil's advocate questions, all your toughest topics. I love that. I think that's where we learn, is where we're able to kind of get in there with each other. So, and it has the end of the story for Joanne and Beckham, some of their backstory, a lot more of that, as well as where they are now and how that has impacted the journey of the organization and my own personal journey. So there's a lot more good that can be done for families who are struggling alongside their loved one. Highly recommend checking out Allies in Recovery. It's an organization that does, you can access their training from anywhere. You can access their support groups from anywhere. It is evidence-based. It is proven that the CRAFT model that they teach helps more people be healthy themselves as they walk with their loved one. And it increases the likelihood that their loved one is willing to make a positive change in their life. So the level of anxiety and stress families feel decreases as they go through this process, which is a huge gift to families who are trying to show up for their loved one and many times just feel at the absolute end of their rope. It just feels like there's no hope. There's nothing that's going to ever change. And they just feel so depleted. There are better options, even in the midst, even if your loved one isn't ready to get help yet, for ways you can be healthy and you can help them. So check out Allies in Recovery. They're good friends of ours. And the CRAFT model is just incredible. And I hope more people learn about it, because all of us want to thrive. We don't just want our loved one to thrive. We want to be able to live that thriving life too. And that's what End It For Good's working towards on this particular issue. We want to see more people able to live lives that are meaningful and that they want to show up for every day.
Christina, thank you so much for being curious enough to write the book, Curious, and also for having this conversation with me. I'm a very curious person, so you've intrigued me a lot more. And thank you for joining me today on the Storybox podcast.
Thanks so much, Jay.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.